The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
The myriad forms of life found in the sea are truly a marvel to behold. They follow definite patterns. They fulfill specific needs. They obey universal laws. Throughout the intricate web of life, a delicate balance exists between the many species at each level of the numerous interrelated food chains. Yet the sea is but one part of the Earth's dynamic ecological system, a system that ultimately includes man himself. In fact, the more you study into this fantastic pyramid of life, the more you ponder the question, how did all this begin? Wherever we look, whether in the sea, at the myriad creatures there, in the forms of life all the way from algae and plankton to the huge great whales, or the land and man himself and mammals, or in the air to the creatures that fly, we see an interacting, interdependent web of life that comprises, like a dynamic, pulsating, living thing, the interacting web of life that really is our biosphere. The sea abounds in a seemingly endless variety of fish. But fish do not produce food and energy on their own. They're ultimately dependent on plants of the sea. Yet throughout most of the sea, there are no plants because in the depths of the ocean, there's no sunlight. But near the surface, if we examine the water with a high magnification microscope, we find that there are uncountable trillions and trillions of tiny plants which drift in the upper levels of the sea. Now, these are diatoms and dinoflagellates which float unseen in the water and produce almost all the food on which the animals of the sea survive. There are also microscopic animals which float and drift in the sea. Together, these tiny floating plants and animals are called plankton. Each of these minute diatoms builds a glassy shell of silicon. Within these glassy shells are many colors, but every diatom contains the green chemical compound called chlorophyll. Since food can only be produced when chlorophyll receives sunlight, an astonishing variety of shapes were created, and people would say evolved in some cases, but I believe created, which helps to keep the diatoms afloat near the sunlit surface of the water where photosynthesis can take place. Each of these intricate patterns is peculiar to one species of diatoms. While they're alive, the diatoms thrive by a method that is not fully understood. Actually, 99% of ocean plants are these tiny microscopic diatoms. It's a good thing most sea animals are not herbivorous, because if these diatoms were all eaten, 50 to 70% of man's oxygen might disappear. Copepods are probably the most numerous of all the planktonic animals, or zooplankton. They spend their whole lives with the plankton. Many of the planktonic animals are little more than large digestive systems, and they eat their weight in plants every day. And all these forms, from worms to oyster larvae, can live in the plankton because of the vast food supply produced by these microscopic plants that comprise the pastures of the sea. This ciliated protozoan eats bacteria. Others may feed on diatoms. This same is true of the amoeboid protozoan. It also eats bacteria. The protozoa may then be eaten by larger creatures, such as this rotifer, it's called. And in turn, this rotifer may be eaten by a larva, say this barnacle larva, and so on up the food chain. Of course, by the time you get to this sea urchin and small fish, you have a substantial increase in size and a decrease in numbers. The point is, all these animals reproduce in huge numbers. The small ones eat smaller and larger, the small, and finally on up to man, and so on, so that hundreds of thousands of creatures and animals in the sea are eating and being eaten and surviving on up the food chain. This is part of our environment. It's part of how we live. It may begin with algae and plankton, or zooplankton as it's called, which is like an intricate interdependability of plant and animal in a symbiotic relationship on which man himself, or a very web of life, or a food chain, depends for his survival. Now, we've seen some amazing microphotography, some pictures, microscopic ones, of plants and animals of the sea, the plankton, the protozoa, the larvae of various species, rotifers, sea urchins, and the like, and how they form the foundation for all larger life forms. But now let's take a look at some of the larger sea creatures and see how they, too, fit into the web of life. This is the economy of the sea. For every single larger animal, there are greater numbers of smaller ones. The diatoms, as we said, outnumber the copepods, and the copepods outnumber the smaller fish. The smaller fish are always far more abundant than the larger ones. Amazingly enough, even the largest animals to ever live, the whales, often feed on the very tiniest of creatures. Whales have been known to eat as much as 3 tons of krill and plankton in a single day. A closer look at the complex system shows that for a single meal, a whale may eat 5,000 fish,
each of which has eaten
6,000 or 7,000 krill, which in turn ate 130,000 diatoms. In other words, the whale ate 400 billion diatoms for just one meal. There's continually going on underneath the surface of the sea a silent game of hide-and-go-seek, a kind of a silent war for survival, a kill-and-be-killed, eat-or-be-eaten struggle that is absolutely essential to man's own survival. So let's understand how it is. The sea around us is actually like a machine that is pulsating with life. Yet each creature in his own right is a separate study all by itself. Each with his own habits of protection, his own methods of food getting or of survival, his own speeds, or maybe if he's a slow-moving creature, his greater camouflage or protection in the form of a shell into which he can crawl backward and then carry it off with him if he needs to, is a very absorbing and interesting study, and I dare say something that is passed over all too lightly in most high school and college courses. We human beings are, after all, only tiny creatures that exist on a globe which is primarily made up of water. And why did we simply end up, as it is by chance, at the fortuitous end of a life web, or a food chain which begins in the sea, the air, the soil, and that we, as human creatures on this glittering orb we call the good Earth, orbiting endlessly in our own galaxy, are utterly unique in all the universe so far as we can know? To study the sea around us is a phenomenon, an exciting thing, inspiring, that ought to be paid more attention to than it really is. Take the case of camouflage and protection. Some fish gain protection by attaching themselves to larger fish or animals under the sea, and others depend on mere size to protect them from enemies. But no individual species is free from danger entirely, or from attack and destruction. And so it is in the life in the sea bottoms, on a day-to-day basis of a struggle for survival. You have every form of motion, every form of symbiotic relationship, the smaller attaching itself to the greater. You have every form of interdependency of life, and man himself is in so many ways totally dependent upon little seen and little understood life forms that continually live, die, are recreated on the bottoms of the ocean and the shallow continental shelves, where billions upon billions of fish and tiny microscopic little animals are busily going about their business of helping us survive. I'd like you to write for a beautiful brochure which takes a little bit of a humorous poke of evolution. And the title is rather obvious, Some Fishy Stories About an Unproved Theory. There's a reason for this cute little clownfish here, because I was privileged on one occasion on a visit to Israel to go down to Eilat, down at the southern end of Israel, not southern anymore after they took Sinai, but I mean before that time, down at the northern end of the portion there of the Red Sea that branches into the Gulf of Aqaba. And I swam down about 12 feet, and here were some of these beautiful sea anemones, I believe is the way you pronounce it. And they are poisonous to all of the fish, but this little clownfish and many other species colorful like this can cuddle right down in the tentacles of these sea anemones and can be protected from other larger fish. There's a symbiosis there, a relationship that is very difficult for evolution to explain and to understand. That's why we say there are some fishy stories about evolution. See the pictures and the photography that is here, the evolutionist dilemma on the archer fish, the fact that he spouts and that he doesn't need to. Here's a little fish that has 4 eyes, one set for viewing in the air above the water, another pair for looking down underneath the water. And that's all explained. Here's about one bizarre form of fish that fishes without a license, with a kind of a nature's angler's rod protruding out of his ugly head, and you can have that all explained for you. Your children will really enjoy this. Anglerfish, angelfish. Here's a fish with lungs in the area of Africa that breathes and goes into not hibernation but estivation, which is different, like alligators do. It puts itself into a kind of a mud ball, and then the lake can completely dry out. And then here's a little picture of some fish sleep almost anywhere. I mentioned the clownfish, and it shows a picture of this little beautiful clownfish down inside the poisonous tentacles of a sea anemone, which would be deadly to any other kind of a fish. If you'll write for this brochure, Some Fishy Stories About an Unproved Theory, I think you and your children alike will get a very good kind of a educational uplift out of it, a lot of inspiration, we hope. And a lot of young people have used this for reports in schools, and if their teachers weren't too terribly against religion and God, they got a good grade. You might write in for that. It's free of charge. Well, I have here a pyramid that surmises exactly what I'm talking about. This first one we'll take a look at shows a food chain that begins with these larger plants, about 24,000 of them of all kinds that exist at the bottom of the sea, and thousands of tons we're dealing with, 24,000s of tons. And these are called producers. Now, ultimately, from that first level, they produce food for the first level of consumers. And these consumers, representing about 6,000, remember these are in thousands of tons, are the plankton or the krill. The next level of consumers would be small fish, say about 85 in terms of tons. And at the third consumer level, you see larger fish, about 15. Now, the second type of pyramid that I have here involves about, say, 10,000 pounds of algae to produce about 1,000 pounds of water fleas. And this can then, it's perfect, 10 to 1 in every case, 1,000 pounds of water fleas to produce about 100 pounds of minnows, which produce about 10 pounds of bass, which produces about 1 pound when eaten by a man. So actually, it's all a matter of the inexorable law, the second one, of thermodynamics, which says that in every energy transformation, as you go up the pyramid, you lose some of the original energy. In this case, we've got stored chemical energy in the form of food. But only about one-tenth of that energy gets converted into the flesh of the predator on up the pyramid. Therefore, you can see why there's such a marked reduction in the numbers of animals at the upper levels. And we haven't even considered in this the loss of energy in converting sunlight to plant food. Actually, very little of the energy from the sun striking a given area is ever utilized by the organisms. Measurements made of solar energy striking a Wisconsin lake, for example, reveal that 49.5% was lost by reflection, that 25% in causing the evaporation of water, 21.7% in raising the temperature of the lake, and 3% in melting ice in the spring, while only 0.8% was actually utilized by producer organisms. In terrestrial habitats, utilization is higher, but still does not represent any significant percentage of the total solar energy available. A field of corn, for example, utilizes about 1.6% of the available energy, a deciduous forest about the same, and a grassland somewhat less. Every habitat in nature, every prairie, deciduous forest, tropical rainforest, lake, freshwater stream, tundra, whatever you have, is populated by a characteristic assemblage of plants and animals existing in a biosphere or a food chain or a biological community. For organisms, for example, in the pine forest, each one of them occupies a kind of a communal niche according to the role it may play. The primary source of energy on Earth is, of course, the sun. Green plants convert the sun's energy into the organic matter that all organisms must have to live. In most biotic communities, certain plants provide the main food energy and set the character of that community. Such plants might be called the dominant ones. Now here the pine trees are the dominant ones because, to a large extent, they determine what other kinds of organisms can live here. All the others, large and small, are consumers, and they depend upon the food producers. Here's an herbivore, plant eater. And you see there are several different kinds. The aphis lion competes with the ladybird beetle for a diet of aphids. Primary carnivores serve as food for a secondary carnivore. The lady beetle, you like those in your garden, by the way. If you see them there, don't ever destroy them and don't let your children do it. And carnivores are usually larger and fiercer and somewhat fewer in number than their prey. Some animals occupy more than one niche in this biosphere. Bears, for example, can be either herbivores or carnivores, depending on whether they find the berries or the fish. Some organisms live by feeding on others without killing them. This is the niche of the parasites. Almost every living thing is subject to some form of parasites, including you and me. All organic matter, living or dead, eventually serves as food for some other organism. Dead organic matter, such as this fallen tree, is being eaten by scavengers. Termites occupy the niche of the scavenger in this rotting log. Ants, millipedes, centipedes, which feed on dead organic matter, are also in the vicinity. And the activities of these scavengers break down the log for organisms of another niche called the decomposers. You see that these may be bacteria, yeast, or mold. These organisms convert organic matter into simpler substances which can be used by green plants for their growth, and the making of food makes it available for the entire food energy niche. Wherever they belong in this web of life, there's a fantastic interdependency and a kind of a pyramid-like food chain. So the various kinds of food chains, that is the ways that carbon passes from one to another, are endlessly diverse in any community. Of course, in practice, the patterns become so complicated that it's probably better to think of food webs than food chains, because the word web gets across the idea of a pyramid-like form. But the chain is more easily visualized, even if it is oversimplified somewhat. One chain you might think of is grasshoppers, frogs, snakes, and hawks. The grasshopper, the frog, the snake, or the hawk may die from some intervening cause, and its body material be returned to the soil by the decomposers. Or the grass may die and be decomposed without passing through any animal at all. The decomposers, mostly microbes and fungi, are always with us, playing a very essential role, reducing the carcasses of plants and animals to their component materials so that the cycle can start all over again. Let's take a look at the prairie community and see how this works in prairie grass. Grass is the dominant producer in this area, giving the community its name, the grassland. Yet based on this primary source of food is a whole chain of organisms, from the small to the large. Worms, butterflies, and grasshoppers are just a few of the many animals directly feeding on the grass. And needless to say, it takes a great many herbivores or plant eaters to feed one primary carnivore or meat eater. A bird, for example, may consume great numbers of worms, beetles, grasshoppers, and so on. Or we might have the sequence where grass is eaten by the grasshopper is then eaten by the frog, and the frog is then, I'm sorry about this, but that's what happens in nature, eaten by the snake, and finally the snake gets his by the hawk, and there's your food chain. Because the hawk has no larger predators except man that kills him needlessly, he is the top carnivore in his own food chain. Another example is the rabbit, which eats the grass, and he's chased by the fox, and he's caught and is eventually eaten. And because it eats other animals too, the fox is a link in several food chains. The fox is top carnivore in his food chain. Yet it may be attacked by organisms of another niche, like parasites, such as ticks and disease organisms. Since there is dead organic matter, we know there will be scavengers. Flies and beetles occupy that niche here, when the remains of a carcass are to be consumed. Bacteria and fungi occupy the niche of decomposers, and they convert the organic matter into substances that green plants can use as food, forming the basis for the cycle of matter and energy in the community, with its many niches and its food web. So wherever you look, whether in the sea, whether in the grasslands, the plains, whether the desert itself, whether the Arctic tundra, or whether even in the air, or whether inside of and upon your own body, you see a food chain. It's too bad that some of those that advocate never stepping on a bug or never, you know, killing a single thing, such as many people that try to prevent hunting and the harvesting of a game crop, that do not understand these principles of a food web or a food chain, and that man himself is a predator and is at the top of all, really at the end of all of these food chains. It's too bad they cannot understand that that fish that they feel such pity for, being caught by the sportsman, was trying to kill a smaller fish when it was caught in the act. But that's another subject, and I won't digress on it. Now, here's a third graphic, and we have here at the base of this about 6 million plants, grass and flowers, as the primary producers. Then about 700,000 primary consumers, various plant-eating insects like grasshoppers, snails, beetles, and the like. And then about 350,000 secondary consumers, carnivorous creatures like spiders and ants. And finally, about 3 tertiary consumers, carnivorous vertebrates such as birds and moles. In another example that we know about, there was a square mile of Arizona range which was studied. It was found it supported 1 coyote, 2 hawks and 2 owls, 45 jackrabbits, 8,000 wood and kangaroo rats, and 18,000 mice. It's been estimated that 20 million alfalfa plants, that's 17,850 pounds. Listen to this. Next time you buy a Spencer or a New York cut steak, you'll appreciate it a little more, even in spite of the high cost, which I believe blows your mind today. But it takes about 20 million alfalfa plants, 17,850 pounds, that is, to feed 4.5 calves, 4.5 calves, that would provide 2,250 pounds of meat necessary to furnish the energy required by one 12-year-old boy weighing 105 pounds for 1 year. Now, obviously, that means that steak is both an economic and an ecological luxury. So the point I'm making is merely this. We live in a fantastically interrelated, harmonious, complex food chain. There are so many examples of this. I have always made it a rule never to throw anything outside of the house or the car. I say always, well, I've tried to in many, many recent years. That is not organic. Actually, if it is organic, it doesn't really matter. That includes a toothpick or a piece of wood, not a matchstick if it's burning, of course, because it's going to go back into the soil. Today, man interferes in his biosphere by putting into our natural environment those things which befoul our nest, such as very toxic and deadly poisons which interfere with the food chain. Sometimes farmers will spray on their grounds various types of fertilizer and then pesticides and insecticides, and they will come along and kill harmful pests. But unfortunately, along with the harmful ones that they kill, many helpful ones die too. Then birds may eat larvae or insects which have been infected, and the birds then may die. Or it may affect the birds' bodies, as in one case of a pelican type that I know about on the west coast of the United States. So when the birds, and also this is true of the peregrine falcon and some other types of birds, when the birds then lay their eggs and they try to sit on the eggs in the nest to hatch them, the egg does not have the type of shell it should because of an inability of the bird's body, now altered by this chemical formula it's been eating as a part of its normal food chain consumption, because it is eating some of the producers. It's at one level of the carnivores in the food chain, and so it can't produce the kind of a firm egg that it needs to hatch its young, and in some cases the young simply cannot be hatched, and so there are no new young being born. Other cases where this might occur are when it rains, and then the water is either leaching off through the soil and the subsoil water table, or perhaps on the surface into streams, finally rivers, maybe estuaries. And along the way, millions upon millions of fish may die. Not only do the fish die, but the waters, the rivers, the lakes themselves sometimes become like chemical soups of nothing but dead bacteria. There are many, many cases now we've heard of recently where big cities, we first heard about New York, and we heard recently about Los Angeles. Before that, I was talking a great deal about Lake Erie and how it really is very eerie, and meaning the two E's spelling in that, because of sludges that begin to collect on the bottom even of the offshore continental shelves off of New York City and Los Angeles. And we discover now that raw sewage and chemical compounds and the like builds up a kind of a fungi that really completely alters the biosphere and the normal ecosphere of these food webs that exist there. And so in so doing, man is again interfering in his own environment. You know, man is the only creature that does that. These other creatures, no matter how bizarre that may look, for that poor frog that your boy may bring home in his pocket, say, look, Mommy, I got a frog. You just dearly hate to see that frog about halfway down with those staring eyes. I know it, but it's happening thousands of times every day. Millions, what am I saying, thousands? Thousands of times, probably, in a few square miles of some swampland in Wisconsin in the right time of the year. And the same thing is true when you go out and catch a northern pike or a trout or a bass. That fish got to that size because it's been eating thousands of little, tiny, defenseless fish, and sometimes even its own babies. The birds, the chickens that you eat, for example, if you ever let their feet touch the ground, which is not true in some areas where they raise chickens, are eating insects. And sometimes, if you're not careful, and that's why they crop the top part of the beak on many chickens that live in these big chicken farms, they will even eat each other. That doesn't seem to really dramatically alter the kind of flesh that a chicken has, so that he is still palatable for you. And you can eat the chicken, but that's the way it is. We are both herbivores and carnivores. Some of us herbivores only by choice, and I'm not talking about me. I enjoy a good steak as much as anybody, no matter how many people may condemn me for that. But man lives at the very bottom, when it's talking about the air and the mountains and so on, basically close to sea level, and at the very top, when you're talking about the seas, of the food chain. Look at it this way. The depths of the sea, thousands and thousands of feet in the abyssal depths of some of the Marianas Trench areas of the ocean, and the tops of the highest mountains are the most inhospitable for all life forms. The closer you come down toward sea level from the mountaintops, and the closer you come toward the shallow waters in the bays and estuaries of the oceans, the more myriad forms of life, the more readily at hand it is for man. He merely reaches up to the tree or stoops down to the shallow waters, and there is man's food supply. It isn't really fair to say, then, in one sense of the word, that man is at the top of the food chain. He's right smack dab in the middle of it. Somebody arranged something so beautifully to make it so convenient for man that it's scarcely all you can believe and marvel at and come to understand. The question is, how did it happen? These brochures, called A Whale of a Tale or The Dilemma of Dolphins and Duckbills and Some Fishy Stories About an Unproved Theory, show you unanswerable questions to the subject of evolution. Is it true, as we look into the intricate web of life that exists on this earth, that the closest living relatives to crocodiles are birds? That's like saying mosquitoes and elephants are related in some strange way. Are you the result of evolution, or were we all of us, even the symbiosis you see in creatures in the sea, and the air, and the soil, the bacteria, the fungi, the herbivores, carnivores, and man himself, all placed here for a great purpose? You ought to write right now for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine. The Plain Truth magazine, a magazine of understanding, is published on three continents, read in all inhabited parts of the world, read by literally millions of people, and goes absolutely free of charge. For example, your already paid subscription is read by perhaps about 3 to 5 million people, and it's printed in several different languages, distributed around the world. You will find people reading The Plain Truth in the Azores, the Canary Islands. You'll find them down in parts of Africa, the periphery of Asia, throughout India, in Indonesia and the Philippines, by the tens of thousands. People all over Europe, behind the Iron Curtain, in the French language, the German, the Spanish language, in other publications and articles from the Plain Truth magazine, and our English language edition printed in Europe, in Australia, and in the United States, sent free of charge every single month to 3 million households and read by millions. Where does the money come from to support it all? I've heard everything in the rumor mill from Howard Hughes to Las Vegas gamblers to little old ladies in Pasadena down to the John Birch Society. Well, there is a church behind the Ambassador Colleges and this program. It's called the Worldwide Church of God. Its members are baptized in an immersion ceremony exactly as our Baptists, and I guess there are other churches that practice that as well. And they are bona fide baptized members. And like the Mormon church, and like, in that way of thinking, all churches really, we practice the biblical doctrine of tithing. And that means that about 85 to 90% of all of the total support for the entire globe-girdling work, of which this is one part, is supported directly by the tithe-paying membership of the Worldwide Church of God, which means that about that remaining 12 to 15, it may vary, percent, would come in by voluntary contributions from people unsolicited who, frankly, and I think it's obvious to see that while there is no intent that that is what happens, it is obvious that it would happen. That when people become involved in subjects that are so vitally important to their own personal lives, whether it's their marriage, their home, whether it's a question of morality, a question of agriculture, a question of a doctrinal nature, they receive food. I mean good meat to really sink their teeth into and to think about, that in many ways can alter and change their lives for the better. Sometimes people voluntarily contribute, but that is not the aim of the program, as you so well know. And in all of the public meetings that we have had, that includes some of the personal campaigns from which I make those summer specials, we never take up collections. There is not any request for literature in any of these booklets. I'm sorry, request for money. None of the literature we send out does that, and that includes the Plain Truth magazine. All you need to do is to write to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California. That's the only address you need, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for your free copy. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, see you next time. Thanks for inviting me into your home.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.